First Timothy chapter 3. Is there anyone that does not have the outline that needs one this morning? First Timothy chapter 3. All right. Travis, if you'll help me here. Anybody else other than Miss Sue? All right, Misty. Thank you, sir. First Timothy chapter 3. Looking at the qualifications of a bishop, or someone has called that the expectations of a bishop. Neither word is used in the listing of these 16 things, but there are some requirements, some expectations of a man who would fill the office of a bishop. We talked about the office of a bishop being synonymous with that of a pastor, looked at the cross references, so we'll not belabor that point. And he desires a good work. It is a work, and he has to have a desire for it. You cannot just place someone in that position because they're qualified if they do not have the desire for it. Many people spend their working years at a job they do not like just to get through it, to get to retirement. And what a unhappy way to have to spend life. Maybe some of you have done that. Talked to a fellow that had a factory job, and he just despised going to work every day, but he did it for 30 years till he could retire at a young age and did it. If a man desires the office of a bishop, he's got to have a desire. He's got to want to do it. He's got to have enjoyment or pleasure in doing it. The bishop then must be blameless. We talked about that. The husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality. Talked about the root word of that was hospital, giving care to others. Apt to teach is where we closed out last week, having an aptitude, a natural ability to be able to teach. Then that brings us down to verse number 3. And the first requirement there, and of course these are all spelled out on our outline, but I hope you'll take some notes on here. Not given to wine, verse number 3. If a man desires the office of a bishop, he should be not given to wine. That simply means this, and this is a rough one. He doesn't drink. That's what I mean, not given to wine. He doesn't drink. He's a teetotaler, as they call it in our day, in our time. That kind of eliminates all Catholic priests right there, historically, not given to wine. Sadly, in our day, it eliminates half of the Protestants that are preaching too, because it says not given, no desire for, no propensity toward, not given to wine. A lot of folks want to argue that thing about wine in the Bible, and granted, it is a challenging study. There's a difference between new wine and old wine, and you have to differentiate between the two. There are some verses that you could interpret to mean that it's okay to drink a little bit, but the majority of verses would discourage that. A study of wine in the Bible is a very interesting study. We won't do a thorough one, but go back to Genesis, to the first mention of wine in the Bible. And that's always the best way to find out what any subject is about, is to look for the first time that it's mentioned. And the first mention of given to wine is back in Genesis chapter 9. And it's not a bad guy. It is Noah, after the ark. Genesis chapter 9. Verse 18, and the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark, so this is coming out of the ark, were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham is the father of Canaan. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. Every person on earth comes from one of three races, that from Ham, Shem, or Japheth. We've done that study before, the table of nations in Genesis chapter 10. Verse 20, and Noah began to be an husbandman, and he planted a vineyard. No problem. Probably something he did before the flood. And now after the flood, he planted a vineyard, and he did what he did before. He drank of the wine. This is the first mention of the word wine in the Bible. And what is the result of the first mention of the word wine? And he was drunken and uncovered in his tent. You can't beat it with a stick. The first time that alcohol, the first time that wine is mentioned in the Bible, a man ends up drunk and naked. And that's pretty well a standard anymore. When people drink, they get a propensity toward disrobing, not being conscious of being out of their mind and not being aware of their circumstances and what they're doing. Parties, drunkenness, and nakedness, that's just that the two kind of go hand in hand. Now, we kind of give Noah a pass at this time because he did it unsuspectingly, I believe. That's accurate. He planted a vineyard. Wine simply, new wine is simply grapes squeezed into a cup. That's what wine is. Grapes squeezed into a cup. We would call it grape juice. The Bible calls it wine. When Jesus turned the water to wine, you hear people say this all the time, Jesus drank wine. First of all, no, he didn't. That's a complete inaccurate statement. There's nowhere in the Bible that says Jesus drank wine. Now, he turned water into wine, and others drank of that wine, but there's no verse that says Jesus drank it. So, first of all, that's something that people are parroting they've heard said before. Second of all, that water he turned to wine was not an alcoholic beverage. It's simply grapes squeezed into a cup. When you and I take the Lord's Supper, which we'll do, by the way, Sunday evening, November 6th, when we take the Lord's Supper, we take that cup. And when Jesus gave them the cup, he gave them unleavened bread and unfermented wine. All right, unleavened bread, because leaven is a type of sin. Unfermented wine, because fermentation is a type of sin. And so there was no fermentation, but it was still called wine. Here it was wine. It was simply grapes squeezed into a truck. He was a husbandman and planted a vineyard. All right, you got it? Vineyard, squeezed cup. Now what happened to Noah on this day? How did he end up drunk? He did not purposely go out there to drink something that would cause him to be drunken. But because of the flood and because of the canopy of the earth being opened and the environment completely changing, something happened post-flood that never happened pre-flood. And that is that as that wine sat, it began to move itself aright in the cup. That's the way Solomon describes it, and we'll see that verse in just a moment. It began to ferment, and Noah had no idea about it. And he went and drank wine, grape juice, as he always had done before, but now this stuff had a bad effect on him, and he ended up drunken and naked in the tent. Look at Genesis 19. The second time people actually drink wine in the Bible, Genesis 19. Now there is another mention of wine between the two, and that is when Melchizedek shows up. He comes with bread and wine, and again that's talking about that New Testament new wine. And Melchizedek, a type of Christ and all that kind of stuff. Nobody actually, it's not spoken of drinking it there, so we're kind of passing that one to Genesis 19. And Genesis chapter 19, verse 30. Lot is fleeing from Sodom and Gomorrah. And Lot went up, verse 30 of Genesis 19, and Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain, and two daughters with him. For he feared to dwell in Zoar, for he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. And the firstborn said unto the younger, Our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. And they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he perceived not when she lay down, nor when she arose. The rest of the story tells us the two daughters of Lot were with child by their father. How did they get him to do such an immoral thing? Well, he knew not that they laid down with him. He had no idea what was going on. Why? He was full of wine. He was drunk. So the first two instances of this, we've got nakedness, drunkenness, immorality, incest. Now some Christian says, well, I don't think there's anything wrong with drinking a little wine. Read your Bible. You know, if you never take the first drink, you won't take the second drink. You know, that's rocket science theology, I know. Difficult to understand. If you never take a first drink, you'll never get drunk. If you never take a first drink, you'll never become an alcoholic. You never take that first drink, you'll never waste your paycheck on alcohol and drinking and all that kind of stuff. There is no justification, even among Christians, for drinking wine. Look, if you would, one more reference. I made reference to it, Proverbs 23. Proverbs 23, a man desires the office of a bishop, he is not to be given to wine. He is not to be a drinker. Proverbs chapter 23, probably my favorite passage on all this. Proverbs 23 and verse 29. Who hath woe? Anybody want to volunteer for woe? Who hath contentions? Something that makes you argumentative. Who hath babbling? You ever been around one of these people? That's why I love this description, because it's so accurate. Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? They that tarry long at the wine, they that go to seek mixed wine. So you want woe, sorrow, contention, babbling, wounds without cause, redness of eyes? Drink. Drink wine. Someone says, well, it says they that tarry long. Well, look what he says in verse 31. Look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth his color in the cup. That's the fermentation process. As it sits and ages, it ferments. Those that are wine aficionados, or whatever the word would be, will talk about the year of that wine and where it came from, and the older the better, because it has aged so well. And that's what he's talking. Don't even look upon it when it giveth his color in the cup, when it moveth itself aright. At the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Yes, that's what I want. Bitten by a serpent. Thine eyes shall behold strange women. Thine heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or he that lieth upon the top of a mast. When a person is given to wine, they drink. And they've drank too much. They've overdrank. Everything's moving. They stagger. It says in verse 34, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or he that lieth upon the top of the mast. Everything moving around him. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When shall I awake? And here's the catch of the whole thing. I will seek it yet again. Alcohol is an addictive substance. It is a house ruining, a home ruining substance. There's no benefit to it. You say, so why is it legal? Because there's money to be made. That's the only reason. There's a lot of money in it. So the Bible says about a bishop, he's not to be given to these things. In fact, it'd be good for him. I'll have to write this down for future reference. It'd be good for that pastor, that bishop, to preach about the evils of wine. Maybe I'll do that one of these days, as if we just didn't do it right now. We'll talk about that. And many preachers will not open their mouth and talk about the evils of drink for fear of their congregation. That there are those in the congregation. I look around and I say, yeah, look at all the drunkards that are here this morning. But there are some preachers. Daryl, don't point at your wife like that. But there are some preachers that have to be careful. They can't preach on these things because many of their congregation will get upset with them over it. And to be honest with you, I know I'm safe here, but even if there was somebody here that might get upset, I still have to preach and teach it. I can't avoid the subject because the Bible teaches it right there. And how do you miss that? The first mention of wine, drunkenness and nakedness. The second mention, immorality and incest. Here in Proverbs, that's not the third mention, but here in Proverbs, the obvious admonition of the Lord, don't get near it, don't touch it, don't even look upon it. Because if you do, you'll go through all these terrible things and then say, when I awake, I'll desire it, I want it all over again. So a bishop is not to be given to wine. Back to verse number 3 in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Not given to wine. Letter I, or number 9 in our list of 16 requirements. Number 9 is no striker. What is a striker? Well, that's, I want to strike him. I'm not talking about the Astros and the Phillies here in the World Series. We're talking about punching him out. No striker. A man that's in the ministry has to have a very patient disposition. Cannot do even, I saw a picture the other day, and I don't know if it was accurate or not, but it was a football player, I think a Carolina Panther, on the sideline, and the coach was reaming him out for something he did, one thing or another. I don't know any of the information, but I just saw the picture, and they circled his left hand as the coach was chewing him out, and you could see it balled up in a fist, just ready to strike. And I thought, well, my first thought was, if the guy's right-handed, balling up his left hand doesn't mean a thing. And you couldn't see his right hand. So, you know, you always got to be careful of those memes and pictures and all that kind of stuff. Be a critical thinker. Think those things through. But they showed him balling up his left hand as if he's going to strike the coach. There are lots of times in the ministry where a pastor would, not physically, but spiritually, ball up his fists and just say, I want to knock that guy out. And you can't be given to that, because that would be an easy temptation to do. I've told people this. I was a Marine before I was a Christian. And sometimes being a striker is the best answer for things, but that's not the right answer for anything. All right, so if a man desires... And some guys have been saved from very tough lives, very aggressive lives, and if they're going to get into the ministry, they've got to be able to calm themselves down and not be given... to strike you. Now, that's not talking about not defending yourself in a self-defense situation. The Bible is not against that. You have every right to defend yourself, to defend your family. But when it comes to just one-on-one situations, the response is never, well, I'm just going to knock his lights out. That's not true. I'm just going to slap them silly. You can think it, but you can't do it. That's all there is to it. You're not allowed, all right? And again, these are things that are not just applicable just to preachers, but as we said before, these 16 things should be true of every believer, every Christian. And then so much so, as you're choosing a pastor from that group of Christians, they have to exemplify these things. But all of us should be true of them. No striker, letter J, number 10 in the list, in verse number 3, not greedy of filthy lucre. Not a money grabber. Not motivated by money. Not greedy of filthy lucre. Not consumed with thoughts of making the next buck. How to make the next investment. Many things in the ministry are not financially profitable. A children's ministry is never financially profitable. To run the bus, to bring in kids, all the times we take, everything that's going on downstairs right now. Teachers that are not up here in the adult Sunday school class that would benefit from being up here and getting taught to and learned. Those in junior church that would benefit from being up here. Yet we're taking them out of this service and putting them down there and putting them among a bunch of children, some of which, as soon as they get 14, 15, 16, will decide they don't want to go to church anymore when they can make the decision. All this investment, the money for the bus, the money for all this goes into it, and you don't get a dime back from it. And if you're given to profitability, you'd eliminate the children's ministry. And many churches have done exactly that. Canceled their bus routes, don't have Sunday school classes, don't have junior church, because it's not profitable. We can't base our decisions on profitability. All right? They have to be based on spiritual dividends, not monetary dividends. So when it says not guilty of filthy lucre, the pastor is entrusted, though he doesn't count the offering, hopefully. He doesn't count the offering and take care of those things that way. He is entrusted with the oversight of finances. And there is always a possibility and always an open door for him to do something backhanded behind the door. I have people all the time handing me money. This is for the church. This is for this thing. This is for that thing. And if a pastor can't be trusted with money, he's not in the right position. He's not where he should be. He needs to, I'll tell you this, I fear God. And if somebody hand me some money and I go, somebody will hand me some money on a Sunday morning or Sunday evening and I put it in my pocket with the intent of putting it in my office, and I drive home after church and I take my suit off and realize it's still there, I break out in perspiration. I set it right there on the counter, right there on the desk, and make sure I got to get this back there. I don't want it to be here. And sometimes that happens. Now, I can honestly say it's all gone where it's supposed to go. Praise the Lord for that. But a pastor has to have that disposition, because he is in a position where he can embezzle. He can pilfer funds. So he's got to be able to be trusted in that way. In reference to this, turn over one page, 1 Timothy chapter 6. And this is the warning that Paul had to give Timothy. He's a young man, again, about 25 years of age, not reached full maturity, and his temptations are many, as fleeing youthful lust. We've read about many of his temptations. And Paul has to tell him this in 1 Timothy chapter 6, and verse number 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. Be content with such things as you have, all right? Verse 7, for we brought nothing into this world, it is certain we can carry nothing out. Having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. There is an indication in 1 Timothy that Timothy had given preference to those in the congregation of wealth. And so Paul is warning Timothy about that. Don't put someone in the ministry because they got money. Don't ordain someone for that reason. And be careful of yourself, because he says in verse 10, for the love of money, again, it's not money. Money's not the root of all evil. It's the love of money that is the root of all evil. That doesn't mean you can't be successful. Doesn't mean you can't invest. Doesn't mean you can't buy and sell. Doesn't mean it just means be careful you don't have that overwhelming desire and love for money. And if a man desires of the office of a bishop, he's got to be very careful, because you don't go into it for the money. You'll make more money outside than you will inside. So not greedy of filthy lucre. Back to 1 Timothy 3. But patient. That's the one I'd like to skip. But patient. Now, fortunately, it doesn't say, but patient when he's driving. It doesn't say that right there. And that is my thorn in the flesh. But patient. If a man desires the office of the bishop, he's got to be patient. Look back at 2 Timothy chapter 2. The next book, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24. And the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, apt to teach. We saw that, and here's the word again, patient, in meekness instructing those that oppose themselves, if God peradventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth, that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil. So the pastor, the bishop, has to have patience with himself, patience with others. That's what he's talking about here. In meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves. Many preachers beat their heads against the wall because people in their congregation are not doing what they told them to do. We don't have total control over the actions of everybody. We can make suggestions. We can make recommendations. We can preach general truths from the Bible on sin and on righteousness. But people don't always do exactly what you want them to do, and you've got to have some patience with people. Haven't we all learned that in life? We have to have patience with one another. So there's patience with themselves, patience with people, patience with church problems. Many times something will come up and you can rush in like a bull in a china shop and fix it and take care of it and make a bigger mess than had you been a little bit more patient. Now, patience and procrastination often can merge together, and you got to be careful and know the difference between the two and know when you're doing one and when you're doing the other. But patience with church problems, patience with church finances, going back to the previous one, not guilty of filthy lucre, patient with church finances, not being rash and going out and spending church money or buying things or panicking when there's not enough money to pay the bills, the Lord will take care. So a lot of patience required of a man that desires the office of a bishop. Again, these are not necessarily what you'd find on a job application in 2022 or what people would put on their resume. A guy's not going to put, I'm blameless. The husband of one wife, vigilant and sober. Most businesses don't care about those things directly, so they're not on there. All right, letter L. Number 12, again in verse number 3. not a brawler. Now there's an interesting word, not a brawler. Now the first thing that comes to mind, what's the difference between a brawler and a striker? Because when we think about brawling, we think of two wrestlers, two guys going at it, duking it out and fighting. But the word brawler does not mean that. The word brawler means contentious or argumentative. Contentious, argumentative, disagreeable. That's what the word brawler means. It's not the actual fist fight, but it's the attitude that leads to it. Contentious, argumentative, disagreeable. Those are the words that I put down. Here's what Webster's 1828 dictionary, the first English dictionary, here's what they put as a definition for the word brawler, just to show us we're on the right page. To quarrel noisily and indecently. That's how Noah Webster defined that term in 1828, which is closer to the time of our Bible and its translation. It meant to quarrel noisily and indecently. That's what a brawler is. And a pastor, a bishop, is not to be a brawler, not to be argumentative, not to be contentious. Look at Titus chapter 3, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, then Titus. In Titus chapter 3, verse 2, to speak evil of no man, to be no brawlers. See, that word is connected to speaking evil of no man, not being disagreeable, not being contentious, not being argumentative, to be no brawlers, but gentle, showing all meekness unto all men. So, not being a brawler, talking about their attitude of not being contentious, defensive, things like that. Back to 1 Timothy chapter 3. And the last thing listed in verse number 3, not covetous. Not covetous. Now we all know what that word means. Not desiring something that is not your own. A man that desires the office of a bishop must be satisfied with what he has. Not desiring someone else's car. Someone else's house. Someone else's wife. And preachers get in trouble for that. I'd go a little farther, not desiring someone else's church. There's a lot of covetousness among preachers. Well, I'd like to have that guy's church. He's got a big church. You know what I found out? Big churches mean big problems. And I'm content. I remember when Brother Sowell was first building their new building up there in Toledo on Hope Avenue, or Hope Baptist Church there on North, I think it is. When they were building, they were still in a different area, and he took all of us preachers over to their new job site where they were going to build their new building. And you could just see some of these preachers green with envy. He had just bought this big old lot, and they're going to build this more than $1 million. They're going to build this big building there. And then he told us their mortgage payments would be $15,000 a month. And that shot the covetousness out of most of us right there. $15,000 a month, all right? And here we are years later, and I don't know if they paid it off or not, but sometimes preachers are guilty of wanting someone else's ministry, someone else's popularity, someone else's fame. And to be content is a great thing in the ministry, not covetous. All right, so we've gone through verse 2 and verse 3, and we have covered 13 requirements. Now, follow me, because there's a purpose in this. In two verses, 37 words. In two verses, 37 words, we have covered 13 qualifications. In verse 4 and 5, 37 words. The first one was 35 words. From verse 2 and 3, 13 qualifications and 35 words. The next two verses are 37 words and one qualification. Sometimes people say, well, out of all these qualifications, which is the most important? I'm not sure any of them are more important than the others. And yet at the same time, God has taken two verses and 37 words to cover number 14, when he took that much time covering 13 of them in the previous two verses. What is number 14, or letter N? It is one that ruleth well his own house. Paul, by inspiration of the words that God gave him, put an emphasis on how a man rules his own house. One that ruleth well his own children. Ruleth well. He's going to be put in a position of ruling. We covered that back in verse number 1. He's going to be put in a position of overseeing the house of God, the children of God, the family of God. Well, if he's going to do that, he has to rule well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. One that ruleth well his own house, having his own children in subjection in all gravity. If his house is in chaos, he's going to have to spend his time on his house and can't spend it on his ministry. Now, I would simply tell you this, and not for my sake as the pastor that's been here 31 years, but for the sake of those that will follow me afterward. Allow your pastor to have family time. Because if his family falls apart, his ministry falls apart. If his children are unruly, if they're misbehaving, if he is stressing and worrying and has knots in his stomach because his 12-year-old or his 14-year-old or his 16-year-old has gotten in trouble, gotten in trouble with the law, this or that, his attention is going to go there and it's going to detract from his time. He needs to be able to spend time with his family. So allow him the opportunity to do that. Now let me say this also. This is one of 16 requirements, and it seems that God puts a big emphasis on it. But I would be the last one to say that if a guy's got 6 children, 4 children, and 3 of them are great and one of them's a little rebellious, give him some grace. Give him some mercy. Don't say, well, you got one that's just giving you trouble, boot him out of there. And again, this is when they're at home age, not after they've gone from the home, but when they're at home and he's in charge of them and raising them, they're under his roof, they are to be in subjection with all gravity. Why? For verse 5, for if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? If he's got to oversee his house and it's in chaos, the church probably will be too. Turn back, if you would, to 1 Samuel 3. Let me give you two of the saddest stories in the Bible. 1 Samuel chapter 3. Eli, I think for 40 years, is the high priest in Israel. He's now an aged man. You know that Hannah brings Samuel to live with Eli in the temple and entrusts Eli to raise Samuel. This might be the beginning of a problem right there. Hannah entrusted Samuel to Eli's care. Eli's going to raise Samuel. Now Samuel turns out good, and that's the grace of God, because Eli is not a good child raiser. Knows what it says in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse number 13. 1 Timothy 3:13. God is talking to Samuel about Eli, and he says, for I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. God judged Eli. He fell off of his seat. He was an old man and heavy. His vision was dim, and we got news that his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, had been slain in the battle. And then most of all, what bothered him more was that the Ark of the Covenant had been taken. He blacked out. He fell off. He fell off of his chair, and he fell, and he broke his neck, and he died. And God tells us the reason for his death was because he did not restrain his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, from their vileness. They were two priests of the Lord. You can read what they did. They laid with the women that came to give sacrifices to God. they took of the offerings that were given. These were two vile men, raised by Eli, a good man. And he ruled the nation of Israel for 40 years and did a good job. But he lost his own family. Look in 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. We hear a lot about breaking the cycle today of addiction from one generation to the next, breaking the cycle of poverty and things like that from one generation to the next. Well, notice this cycle here. And it came to pass, 1 Samuel 8, verse 1. Came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel. Sorry, Joel. And the name of his second, Abiah. And they were judges in Beersheba. Notice verse 3. And his sons, this is Samuel, his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes, and perverted judgment. Hindsight is 20/20. You wonder, should Hannah have taken young Samuel to be raised by Eli? For Samuel to be raised in a home where he saw how Eli permitted his sons to do whatever they wanted to, and Samuel grew up doing the very same thing. Samuel was a great prophet of the Lord. He anointed Saul to be king. He anointed David to be king. He was a great prophet. He ruled Israel well, but he lost his own family. 1 Timothy chapter 3 says, "One that ruleth well his own children, having them in subjection with all gravity." We've got some more on that, but we'll have to postpone that till next Sunday. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for its instruction and its teaching. Lord, help us always to submit ourselves to the principles of the Word of God. Bless our morning service, those that come to join us now, in Jesus' name.